Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Today we're looking at eating dirt. It's called geophagy. And yeah, I know, we're the show for people who love to eat, so what's with the dirt business? Well, there are people who like to eat dirt. It tastes good to them. Besides, dirt may be saving lives. Our guest, writer Susan Allport, reports on the science and the culture of the eating of dirt. Travel and Leisure magazine's Anya von Bremsen is stalking authentic bouillabaisse in Marseille. Food expert Dory Greenspan is test driving the unappreciated steamer. Poet and novelist Julia Alvarez brings us what she calls a green fable about how a cup of coffee changed a life. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's get the show literally on the road with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Jane, Michael, what's the lowdown on Philly cheesesteaks?
Lynn, you're asking the right people because we just did a Philly cheesesteak taste-off. We ate at five of the top cheesesteak parlors in the city and figured out which among them was the best. No small feat, let me tell you.
Well, Michael, first of all, tell me what it is.
A Philly cheesesteak is shaved thin beef cooked on a griddle along with onions. Some places hack the beef and the onions up together as they cook. Other people cook them separately and pile them into a good loaf of Italian bread and then put a certain kind of cheese in. Now, I'm a little vague about that because different places use different kinds of cheese. Hot peppers are also optional, but it's one of those magical combinations of cheap eats that at its best is transcendent.
I'll tell you what the cheese is. I won't give you a brand name, but every place calls it Whiz. So when you order your Philly cheesesteak sandwich, you order...
Be careful now, Jane.
Okay. Steak with Whiz or double Whiz?
No. See, now Jane's got it wrong already. There's steak with. That means with onions. You say steak with Whiz, that means with onions and with cheese Whiz. You say steak with Whiz bushel means a steak with onions, cheese Whiz, and extra onions, the bushel meaning extra onions. There is an entire language devoted to ordering cheesesteaks, and you must do it right in all the cheesesteak parlors of Philadelphia.
And Philadelphia, city of brotherly love that it is, does not really take to outsiders coming in and dawdling and spending a lot of time ordering their cheesesteaks incorrectly. So you damn well better get this straight before you get on a line with a lot of hungry Philadelphians waiting to eat. You better know exactly how to say it down in the most terse and specific way.
Well, where did you two eat then? Where were these five places?
The five places were Pat's, which is the original in the Italian Market area, Gino's, which is kitty corner from Pat's, opened a little later, Tony Luke's, which is under I-95 and is serenaded by passing trucks, Jim's, which is a kind of Art Deco cheesesteak parlor with actual indoor seating, which most of these don't have, and Lorenzo's, which is a strange sort of cheesesteak place because it's basically a kind of pizzeria, but their cheesesteaks are pretty spectacular.
And who won?
Well,
we think Pat's won.
Pat's, the original, actually was the best. It was the classic cheesesteak because they do not hack up the beef. I loved Lorenzo's cheesesteak because what they do is they take the beef and the onions on the grill and use kind of sharp-edged spatulas to hack them into an almost like hash-like consistency.
What did that man tell you when you were looking at how he was doing that?
Well, I said to him, I said, so most of the other places serve their steak in slices. You hack it up. He said, well, what do you want? A cheesesteak you're going to choke on, or one you can eat right?
But what was Pat's like?
Pat's was a kind of perfect harmony of cheap, greasy beef, because that is what is required. You do not want filet mignon on a cheesesteak. Cheap, greasy beef, well-seasoned onions, a really good loaf of fresh Italian bread, and plenty of salty cheese Whiz that brings all these flavors together.
And it's in the middle of the Italian Market, and you have never seen faces on people. I mean, if just to go there for the people watching, it's like being in a Bruegel painting. I mean, it's really just the most city tough looking people I've ever seen.
And, not to mention the pigeons.
Oh my God. And even the pigeon swagger. I mean, it's like tough pigeons. It's like, you know, they stand there waiting for you to throw a scrap to them and give you this like beady eyed look about, you know, you better, you know, stop eating and throw me something. But it's a great urban experience.
And it's open all night. I mean, if you need a cheesesteak at 3 a.m, you can go to Pat's and get one, which is very important.
There's also actually a little plaque in the ground in front of Pat's that says that Rocky?
In 1976, Rocky ate a cheesesteak here. When they were filming the movie Rocky, I guess Sylvester Stallone went there and ate a cheesesteak, which is commemorized in the sidewalk on a plaque. Which is all dripped with pieces of cheesesteak that people have eaten on top of it, but nevertheless, it's there.
And he doubled his workout time right afterward. Hey guys, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Goodbye, Lynn.
Bye.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me, and any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
Jane and Michael Stern have a new updated edition of their classic book, Road Food. Every week you can hear them here on the Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Anya von Bremsen is a concert pianist turned food professional. She wanders the world for Travel and Leisure magazine, but now she has a new project. Anya is doing a book on the 100 great dishes of the world. Anya, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Anya, which dish are you focusing on right now?
Well, I just got back from Marseille, and guess which dish I was researching there? Bouillabaisse, of course. And, Lynn, it was such an education because, you know, I've tasted bouillabaisse in Paris and in Nice, and, you know, but until I really delved into it, I kind of thought it was this big, nice, you know, seafood soup with all these different things. You know, something that we think when we think Provence, you know, beaches. And I just came back from a literal sort of bouillabaisse orgy in Marseille. I went, you know, to like 6 places. And it's serious work. It is so much food. And it is so sort of special. Because, you know, of course, you know how real bouillabaisse is served. First, you get the broth. And the broth is so intense, it tastes like seafloor. I mean, it's just reduced, you know, and made with a special kind of fish. And then, when you're already full, and of course, the broth, I forgot to say, comes with croutons that you slather with the rouille, you know, which is kind of a special mayonnaise, and then you float them in the soup, and you're completely full. And then you get the main course. And the main course is a huge, tremendous platter of poached fish. And at a good establishment, it will include at least 6 or 7 different kinds. And then you eat the fish, you eat more broth, then you eat the fish again, and the whole thing lasts forever and ever. And by the time you're finished, that's it. And imagine, you know, having to do it lunch and dinner. So it was an amazing experience, but I must say it's something I would do once every 10 years.
I can imagine maybe another problem, too, with garlic. Because the rouille, that mayonnaise, is just packed with garlic. You must have been reeking.
Oh, it's like a garlic bomb. And some of it is really spicy. But that's actually really nice just to cut down and sort of accent, you know, the sheer intensity of the flavor is what just blew me away. Especially, you know, the bouillabaisse in Marseille is made with very special types of fish, and one of the fish that is indispensable for the broth is called rascasse, and it's from the scorpion fish family, and it's gelatinous and it reeks of iodine. It's a very particular fish, but it gives that kind of oomph to the broth, and then you have to eat it, and it's a strange tasting thing. And a lot of the fish I found to be, you know, quite odd, like the conger eel. But it's, you know, it's this graphic, brash, in-your-face meal that you sort of don't think of when you think of this kind of gentrified, lovely version of, you know, the Provençal seaside.
Well, is there such a thing as an authentic bouillabaisse?
Well, they make it differently in different parts of Provence. You know, you'll have the Toulon version will include potatoes. In Martigues, you'll have black bouillabaisse. But there is such a thing as an authentic bouillabaisse of Marseille. And not does it only exist. Certain restaurateurs came together and created a bouillabaisse charter, which sort of safeguards the original recipe and which guarantees diners a certain type of quality. As bouillabaisse by now has evolved into something quite rarefied and quite expensive. Of course, originally it was this kind of trashy fisherman's stew that wasn't even recorded in the chronicles. When historians made bouillabaisse research, they had, you know, a real hard time locating mentions of it. And it was just something that was completely taken for granted and made with fish that would be thrown away. But by now, fish like rascasse is very rare and expensive. And so this bouillabaisse charter in Marseille is there to make sure that you get the real deal, the real product. And for the bouillabaisse to be authentic, it has to come, as I mentioned, in two courses. First, the broth with the roux and the croutons. And then you have to have at least four or five different kinds of fish. This is a bouillabaisse authentique.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where do you want us to go to eat it?
Well, one of the meccas of Marseille bouillabaisse is called Le Miramar. And it's run by two delightful brothers. It's a very, very old-fashioned place, and they do this really sort of heavy-duty, intense bouillabaisse. The most clean, elegant bouillabaisse is in a place called Michel. I mean, theirs is just, you know, impeccable. And the fish is beautifully filleted. They show you the live fish before you order it. And the view is lovely. But I think my favorite place is in the village of Les Gourdes, and it's called L'Escale. And there's this huge wall of glass, and the Mediterranean is sort of seething, you know, and splashing against the window. And they make just, you know, a perfect, perfect, delicious version. It's intense, but at the same time, it's clean, and, you know, it's everything as it should be. And it's a great experience. L'Escale.
L'Escale. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Anya von Bremsen writes about food for Travel and Leisure magazine and is doing a book on the 100 greatest dishes of the world. You can get her recipe for bouillabaisse on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the science and culture of eating dirt, a new interpretation of an earthy appetite, test driving steamers, and open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. As we say all the time, this is a show for people who love to eat. Well, today we're going to look at a kind of eating that some think is barbaric. Yet there's evidence of it in archaeological sites, and it goes on in much of the world, including the United States. So what kind of eating are we talking about? It's eating dirt. And it may explain how humans survived before they learned to grow their own food. The scientific term is geophagy. Our guest is writer Susan Allport, who focuses her work on food, travel, and natural history. Her article, Women Who Eat Dirt, appeared in Gastronomica, the Journal of Food and Culture. Susan, welcome.
Thank you for having me here.
So, Susan, tell me about who eats dirt.
People all over the world eat dirt, but for very different reasons. I mean, primarily it's women, because women tend to have a harder time making their nutritional ends meet than men do. But, in fact, whole populations eat dirt, depending where you are. In the mountains of Peru, people eat dirt in order to be able to survive on the wild potatoes that are growing there. These potatoes, being wild, are full of toxins, very potentially fatal toxins called glycoalkaloids. And the dirts that the people consume with these potatoes help to detoxify them. They absorb those glycoalkaloids and turn those potentially harmful foods into mm-hmm. something that's nutritious.
So the eating of dirt is something that's used to detoxify foods?
That's one of the main reasons for it, and that's one of the most well-substantiated reasons for it. There are other reasons, though, and that is that people for a long time have thought that it contributed minerals to various people's diets, including iron, sodium, calcium, potassium. For women who have a hard time consuming enough iron and calcium, those two minerals seem to be the most important reason, and perhaps the reason why more women eat dirt than men.
How do people eat the dirt? I mean, do they just pick it up off of the ground and eat it? I mean, how is it eaten?
Well, first of all, right, this isn't really dirt. It's clay, and it's called dirt by the consumers, but the scientists would know it as clay. It's a band of subsoil. It's below the surface of the earth. It's not contaminated by any organic materials or by any insects or other bacteria. Nothing is of that sort is in this dirt. If you've ever dug in gardens throughout the world, uh-huh. have this band of clay about 15 inches below the surface, very, very, very fine particles. And those fine particles allow it to absorb toxins that may be in a person's diet.
So do people just dig it up and eat it, or do they prepare it in some way?
It's fascinating how in different parts of the world it's prepared. In Africa, they really are aficionados of their clay and prepare it in numerous different ways. I have before me a piece of clay from Nigeria called Eco Clay, and it looks like a piece of peanut brittle. It's got that shiny tawniness of peanut brittle. It doesn't taste like peanut brittle, but it does have a wonderful earthy taste. It sort of smells like and taste like just earth after a good rain.
Oh.
And that's one piece I have. This has been dried in blocks, and then it's been baked over a smoldering fire to give it this burnt, shiny appearance. Another clay I have, also from Africa but from Ghana, is spindle-shaped. It's very gray in nature, but it tastes very much like the other clay. And it has this wonderful spindle shape that somebody's taken great care in giving it. The clay is eaten in the United States by people in the South, are much less prepared. They are dug up and oftentimes baked in the oven or on top of the stove. Sometimes vinegar or sugar or salt is added to give it more flavor, but they're not as carefully shaped as the ones in Africa tend to be.
What do they, you said one of them, they taste like the way the earth smells after a rain, which evokes, it's lovely. But is it gritty?
It's not gritty. These ones from Africa are not gritty at all. They've carefully chosen where they're digging this clay from, and it's very, very fine, fine particles. So when you taste it, Timothy Johns has described it as tasting like unsalted butter. Clays can be so fine that they just don't taste like dirt at all. These taste a little bit like dirt. They're not as fine as perhaps the clays he's eaten, but there's nothing offensive about them at all.
Yeah, I'm curious. Do animals eat dirt?
Oh, I guess that's the most well-documented form of geophagy that there is. Many, many animals eat dirt. Herbivores, many species of herbivores. We've all heard about elk's lick and other descriptive names of where animals go to consume salt. There's a well-documentation of the mountain gorillas in Rwanda that go up high on this volcanic ridge and consume the soil there 5 or 6 times a year. And that soil is very high in both sodium and iron. And sodium is deficient in mountain vegetation, and iron is needed by any high-altitude living mammal that needs the extra iron for the extra red cell production that's necessary at those high altitudes. So it's thought that that's the reason those gorillas will make those 5 or 6 time a year migrations up to these sites and sit down as a big group and just consume the soil.
You said something earlier that just clicked for me. You said animals go to places where there are salt deposits. Are you saying we're all dirt eaters because we use salt?
Well, that's an excellent connection to make. I would argue that we are, because salt is nothing more than a deposit in rocks, and clay is nothing more than rock that has been broken down into these very fine particles. So I would argue that we all are dirt eaters. We're all geophagists, and we shouldn't look down upon this habit in people. We should try and understand the part that it's played in our being human omnivores, in our being able to adapt to living in different parts of the world.
Susan, thank you.
Thank you.
Susan Allport's article, Women Who Eat Dirt, appeared in the spring 2002 issue of Gastronomica, the Journal of Food and Culture. And it just occurred to me, in addition to eating salt, if you've ever used kaopectate for an upset stomach, you've tasted edible clay. Dory Greenspan writes award-winning cookbooks, works with some of the world's most highly touted chefs, and Dory loves to do test runs on kitchen equipment. Her Tools of the Trade column appears each month in Bon Appetit magazine, and she comes by the Splendid Table regularly to share her latest finds. Hey, Dory, welcome back.
Hi there.
So what have you been testing?
Steamers. I've been steaming.
Huh.
You know, and of course, every time I steam, I think of that scene in Pajama Game. You know, I've got steam heat.
You know. Yes, exactly.
You know, and some steamers give you more steam than others, so you can make the steam a little louder. But I've been playing around with 4 different kinds of steamers. One, I'm sure everyone knows, that, you know, the collapsible basket. I think of it as the flower petal steamer.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah.
It's the one that I started out with, and it's a fine little steamer. It's got it opens up. I think of it as like slow motion time lapse photography as it opens. Mm-hmm, the petals mm-hmm. open, and because it folds and collapses in such a nice way, you can use it in very small pots, just little 2-quart casseroles, or it opens to work in a larger casserole. And it's got little feet that keep the food above the water, because if the food's in the water, you're boiling, not steaming.
Right.
And it also has, remember that little post with a ring on top, which is real good for picking up the steamer and getting the food out. But also you can remove that. Something I have to admit I only recently figured out. But it's super because it means that you can steam something larger.
What do you use that for? Because I always use it for vegetables.
Well, when I'm steaming vegetables, that's the thing that I grab for first. I've never used it for anything really large, like fish or chicken breasts or anything done in papillote. For that, I use other steamers, like the bamboo steamer, the Chinese bamboo steamer,
mm-hmm.
Which I love the look of it. It's a bamboo ring that has bamboo slats along the bottom, and then it has a beautifully woven bamboo top. And it's made to fit perfectly over a wok, but you can use it in a skillet or a pan. You just have to get the fit just right. But the problem that I've had is I keep tasting the bamboo in the food. If you put food directly on it, it also sticks a little. Now, some people may love that. It's not my favorite thing. And
yeah.
So often what I'll do is I'll line the bamboo slats with lettuce leaves or I'll put the food on a plate and fit the plate into the bottom of the steamer and steam over that.
All right, you said you mentioned two, but you said there are two more.
I've got two more. I've got one that's really expensive but really fabulous, and that's a stock pot, big stock pot that you'll use for everything, that has a steamer fitted into it. So it's stainless steel.
Mm-hmm.
The steamer has a rubber gasket so that it fits really, really snugly, and it's tall, maybe about 5 inches or so high, and with a cover that fits snugly. So you can do, Allclad makes one. I never can pronounce this right. Demeyer, D-E-M-E-Y-E-R-E, makes one as well. It's a Belgian company. But they're really expensive. It's $200 for the pot and $90 for the steaming insert.
Ooh.
But they're the kinds of things you'll have for a lifetime.
That's a mortgage. But what's the last one?
The last one's an electric steamer, and we're just starting to see those here. I've seen them often in friends' apartments in Paris where they may only have two burners and tiny little kitchens, and so they use this as an extra heat source. And essentially, it's a reservoir at the bottom and two oblong steaming trays at the top. And the tray is long enough for an 8x4 loaf pan or long, elegant asparagus. And they come with a little bowl for steaming rice. There's an automatic timer and a shut-off. And I find that with these, the steam is so strong and so abundant that food cooks super fast. So you really have to keep an eye on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the two that I like are the Oster, and Cuisinart makes a really wonderful machine, but again, an expensive machine. The Oster machine is about $50, and the Cuisinart is about twice that much, although I found it in Zabar's for $66.
Oh, well, maybe we can find it on the web at a bargain, too. That's
the other
thing.
I bet you could.
Okay, we've got the dissertation on steamers. Hey, Dory, thank you.
Thank you.
Dory Greenspan's columns, Tools of the Trade, appears in Bon Appetit magazine. You can find Dory's steamer picks on the website, and she's also left us with a recipe to fine-tune our steamer skills. It's from her book, The Café Bleu Cookbook, and it's for, are you ready for this, spiced steamed salmon with chutney and chard. And you can find it at splendidtable.org.
Tranquila, mami, tranquila.
Novelist and poet Julia Alvarez has two lives. In one, she's an acclaimed writer, author of a number of books, including In the Time of Butterflies and How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accent. But it's her other life I want to focus on. It's intertwined with her book, really a fable, called A Cafecito Story. Now, in it, Joe, a Nebraska farm boy, grows up to be disillusioned as he sees his family farm turned into an industrial operation. On a whim, he takes a vacation in the Dominican Republic. And there, a cafecito, or a little cup of coffee, changes his life. Julia Alvarez, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, Julia, how does a novelist and poet come to do a book on coffee?
Well, that's a good question. I asked myself that, too. But I'd say 7 years ago, the Nature Conservancy asked me to contribute a story for a fundraising anthology they were doing. And they gave each person a location on. They wanted the writer to visit and write a story based in that location. And they asked me to go back to my native country of the Dominican Republic and travel to one of their sites in the mountains there.
Uh-huh.
And so while I was there, I met a group of small farmers who had banded together and formed a cooperativo, a cooperative, to grow their coffee in the traditional way, which is under shade trees and organically by default. They can't afford pesticides.
Uh-huh.
And start to protect the land, which is being taken over by the big agribusiness plantation model, where they plant the coffee under the sun, they cut down all the trees, and then since the natural ecosystem is gone, they have to spray it with pesticides, so the rivers get polluted, and these farmers are suffering the effects of that. And so they banded together, and we were just so impressed by this little troop of nobodies, you know, who had just gotten the gumption to do this. And, of course, Bill Eichner comes from the Midwest and grew up on a farm, and his heart is for the farmer. And so when they said, will you help us, we looked at each other and we said, sure, you know, get the checkbook. Well, they didn't want the checkbook. Well, they would have wanted that too. But what they wanted us was to join the cooperativo, buy some land in it, in order to keep it from the big plantation co-opting all of that land, and grow coffee with them. So why not, right?
Sounds like a good deal.
So out of this grew what I call a green fable, a cautionary tale for our times.
So you actually are growing coffee?
We are growing coffee. We've got 50 acres. The name of our farm is called Altagracia. And the coffee is also called Café Altagracia, and it's the umbrella under which all these little farmers put their crop. And we actually bring it up here. We started in duffel bags and suitcases, but we brought back just little bits,
right,
to sort of spread around at the local co-op and with local small coffee shops and give them a sample. And now it is, it's a crop that is sold at our local co-op. So we are eliminating the middlemen that take a lot of the profit and that doesn't therefore trickle down to these small farmers.
Well, is this project working for those farmers?
A lot of the farmers are having to close down their farms and sell them off because what they're getting currently is 30 cents a pound for coffee. The coffee has really plummeted, and they can't afford to grow the coffee for that. I mean, ideally, they should be getting $1.25 at least. And when you think that we, with these specialty coffees, pay $10 a pound here, it should seem that this would be possible. But many of them, our farm and our cooperativo is one of the few that is still operating, and we've actually had to cut down the full workforce that we had before. Because we can't afford. I mean, we're operating in the red right now.
I see.
In the red, but in the green too. We hope in terms of the good that's happening in that community and on that mountainside. There are trees back. There are birds back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Poet and novelist Julia Alvarez is author of A Cafecito Story. It's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what was the secret ingredient that made today's cake mixes possible? Well, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what was the secret ingredient that made today's cake mixes possible? Well, the answer is sesame oil. And it was on the box of America's first baking mix, Bisquick. Its identity was hidden on that box because it was simply called Ingredient S. And hiding it made a fortune for General Mills. Now, here's the story. It's from a book, by the way, called I'm a Spam Fan. The year is 1930. Biscuits are big across the country, and nobody has yet dreamt of a baking mix. I mean, if you want a biscuit, you have to light the oven and start measuring. Then late one night on a train, a General Mills salesman discovers great biscuits served up fast because the cook had created his own mix. He had blended the lard and the dried ingredients and kept them chilled. General Mills sees a fortune waiting to happen. Fast biscuits from a box. But there's one hitch. Lard goes rancid, and so does every other fat. Then a GM scientist hits on something unlikely. Sesame oil. It stays fresh. So Bisquick is born, and from it, every cake mix we know today. I just keep thinking about that poor cook on that train. Can you imagine him kicking himself around the block for giving away the secret? We're opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have got Sean on the line. So, Sean, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have discovered the greatest secret for growing tomatoes in the Northwest.
Oh, tell us. Okay.
It is to really embrace green tomatoes.
Are you saying you got this short growing season?
We have an incredibly short growing season.
45 minutes, right?
Yeah, it's like 45 minutes. So for every plant that you grow, you get about a quarter of them, a quarter of the tomatoes actually ripen, and you get to treat them like people treat tomatoes in the rest of the world. And the rest, the three quarters are these, what I think are wonderful green tomatoes, and I've learned how to make green tomato salsa, and I've made green tomato pickles. They get mushy. and I've figured out like green tomato preserves, which are delicious.
But yeah, they're pretty neat.
I'd like to come up with some recipes for, like, I don't know, just a savory dinner thing.
You want to bring the green tomato into your day-to-day life as opposed to putting it in a jar and having it on a shelf.
Yeah.
I hear you. Well, just an aside. Okay, a fast-growing tomato, I have two words for you, early cascade.
Early cascade.
Yeah.
I have not tried that variety.
Just, I set that aside. Now, a couple of ideas. Number one, toast up some fresh chopped chili and the ingredients that go in curry powder. You know, just put this in a skillet. You want cumin, coriander, the chopped fresh chili, some garlic, lots of black pepper, maybe some turmeric.
I have chili growing in my garden, too.
Dynamite. Just put that all in a pan and slowly toast it until the herbs are, the spices, rather, are aromatic. Stir that into sour cream and some yogurt and toss that with red onion and your diced up green tomatoes. It is so good. Now, another thing, an Italian take on this, I've got a recipe in my latest book, and it's very quickly, it's you dice up the green tomatoes and just set them aside. Leave the seeds in them, leave the skin on.
Perfect.
Boil up some bow tie pasta, okay, and as it's boiling, in a big saute pan in olive oil, saute the zest that you've shredded from a whole lemon and 6 or 7 cloves of garlic that you have just cut into big dice. Do a slow saute on that with a little hot pepper. And then what you do is, once the pasta is done, you take about a half a cup of the pasta water and you stir it into that pan to get, you know, like a sauce going. Drain the pasta, throw it in, throw in a ton of the chopped up tomatoes and fresh ricotta cheese and a ton of salt and pepper. It is so good. I cannot tell you.
Is it a ton of salt and pepper the secret?
Well, it's the ton of black pepper and the spice and that acidic quality that the lemon zest has along with the green tomatoes and then the creaminess of the whole milk ricotta.
Wow.
The other thing is, take your favorite apple pie recipe and substitute.
I did do this.
Yes. What did you think?
It was half green tomato and half apple pie.
Yeah, it's exactly the way I like to do it.
And it was it's a little bit milder than the apple pie, but only people who I told had green tomatoes in it.
They don't have a clue. Yeah, normally they don't
people
have a
said,
clue.
People said, it's a mild apple pie.
Yeah, yeah, and if you use Granny Smith apples with the green tomatoes and they're real hot, rock hard ones, you know, they're very tart,
yeah,
it works really nicely. See what you think.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you.
Okay, bye.
Take care. You know, I talk so much that they've given me a new gig. It's called Tuesday Night Kitchen, And it's a new show that we are doing on the web. And it's only on the web. And I get a chance to talk about all the stuff they don't let me talk about here. So it's posted every Tuesday, splendidtable.org. And this week, it's going to be all about salad dressings. Okay, let's get back to these callers. Let's see, who's up? We've got Rick calling. So, Rick, what do you want to talk about?
Well, we garden a great deal, and we put up a lot of food canning. And one of the things that we tried here, besides the, all the regular different kinds of cucumbers that we usually can, you know, put up as pickles, we tried this year something called West India gherkins. And the seeds are very, very small, and the plants came out looking like watermelons, but the fruit is just now becoming walnut size. And they have a lot of spines on them. A lot of very sharp spines.
Oh.
They're not like cucumber spines. They look more like pins sticking out of these little walnut sized kind of pale green cucumbers.
This is a defensive fruit.
Yes, it's you have to pick it from the stem. I could have, but it would have been with gloves, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
So I looked on the net fairly extensively and found a couple of things to do with them, but they, none of it made sense because these a lot of things I had never heard of. So I decided maybe you knew what to, how people, you know, pickle these.
Where did you get the seeds?
From Shumway. They have a lot of exotic vegetables. We probably get about 25 different seed catalogs, but I'm pretty sure it was Shumway. We have an 8x24 root cellar.
Oh, wow. Boy.
And a canning kitchen, just a can in.
Ooh. So, this sounds like, to me, this is luxury. You know, you can have the hot tubs. This is luxury.
We have the hot tub, but we have the 3-acre garden out there with the orchard.
Great. I have to confess to you, I don't have a clue about these.
I can't believe I stumped you.
I've
never heard it done before.
Listen closely. It happens fairly regularly. But the reality is, when you first started to talk, I thought a West Indian gherkin, it's going to be one of these small cucumbers. Sometimes they almost taste like melons. But the spines, have you tasted it?
No, we haven't.
Because the taste is going to tell you something, too. You know what I think I would do? Go to the Splendid Table website and go to the forum. This is where everybody talks about food. And I'll bet that if you put up a question about this, you're going to get a flock of answers.
Great.
There's a ton of people. They have this broad frame of reference. You know, I don't have a clue, and I'm sorry. I really don't have a clue.
That's great. It's not great. I just feel honored.
I'm so glad you feel that way. You know, the other thing is contact the seed company. See if they can tell you, you know, some of the sources and how it's used, because they may have a clue about it.
It's a thought.
The other thing is if you can get one, you know, cut into it and just take a little bite of the inside and see what you've got to. Because that might tell you. You may want to scoop out the inside and you know, do a fast saute as you can do with a cucumber. You know, in a little tiny bit of olive oil with salt and lemon zest, and you got a great thing. But
we came out with several bushels of extra cucumbers this year, and my mom came over to help can, and she decided to make hot cucumber boats.
Ooh.
And I have to tell you, it was the biggest culinary disaster of all time. It was the Titanic of culinary disasters. We fed the raccoons, the possums, whatever they are, whatever's eating them out in the woods. It was like we took it out there and we felt like we ought to bury it, not even let the animals near it.
I think there are some dishes that are the reason why compost piles have been
so
successful.
That's exactly right. The hot cucumbers, the idea.
It's get the seeds out and you take chunks and you do the fastest saute you can imagine, like 30 seconds in and out.
Okay.
I mean, it's the French do it. Now, I pass this on to you.
Well, there in itself is a reason not to do it. If you've ever been over there, I'm sure you have a million times from listening to you. It's like,
I wouldn't agree with that. I would. All right. We won't go there.
No. I won't go there. I only go there when I have to.
Hey, Rick, check out the Splendid Table Forum, and thanks. You did stump me.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. 800-537-5252. Okay, I have to confess, I'm tomato obsessed. You probably realize this by now. But it's canning time. And I see something happening in my farmer's market all the time that I just can't believe. People go, they're going to spend hours over a hot stove canning so that they have tomatoes for the rest of the year. And they buy by the bushel and they never taste what they're buying. So please,
taste before you buy. And the other thing you should know is the ripoff tomato of all time is the Roma. So please, it doesn't have a lot of flavor. And there are other paste tomatoes, you know, thick flesh tomatoes that are really great, like Polish paste and ox heart. And there's nothing wrong with canning just regular tomatoes. They're dynamite when you can them and you make sauces and stuff with them. So just do me a favor. Taste before you invest all that time and money. And then please skip the Roma. Think about some other things that you might want to can when you're going after the tomatoes. That's my say for this season. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, who's up? We have Donna calling. So, Donna, what do you want to talk about?
Well, Lynn, this is awfully embarrassing. I was given a whole prosciutto quite a long time ago.
You mean a prosciutto ham?
And I am worried about it being okay. It's been in a refrigerator, and it is in the vacuum seal,
yeah.
But it's been there for quite some time. I can't even begin to tell you how long. I'm not sure if it would even slice now. But how long is cured meat good?
Donna, don't be embarrassed, by the way, because although I cannot name names, I have been known to hang on to certain things with that idea, you know, of I'm going to save this for a special occasion, which happens 4 years later.
That's about it.
You are in great company. Don't panic. Okay, so it's a prosciutto, which is dry cured. Is it from Italy?
I think so.
Oh, boy. Somebody gave you a real treasure, didn't they?
I know.
Yeah,
and
I don't want to make you feel bad.
Diamond ring.
Yeah, I know. I I've never kept one that long. It's vacuum packed. I think the only thing you can do is open the baby up. The first thing that's probably going to happen is that if anything's gone bad, it's going to be the fat.
Uh-huh.
Because often what happens with these meats is that depending on how they've been stored, they don't go bad. They just, because if you cut away any mold on the outside or whatever, the inside's fine. It's just that they get so strong tasting.
Yep.
They get so deeply salty because the moisture keeps evaporating. If it had open air circulating around it, there's a better chance it would be as dry as a bone, but still be unmolded. Wrapped airtight, I'm not sure. Open it up. Okay. Trim off some of the fat. Look at what the meat looks like. It should look almost like raw meat in the sense that it should be pinkish in color. And smell it. If it smells really, shall we say, gamey, it's probably over the hill in the sense you're not going to want to eat it.
Okay.
But I would cut to the heart of it first before making a final decision and take a sniff there and a little taste because the center of the hand.
I was afraid of making someone sick.
I don't think you will, but don't eat any mold that's on it. And if it smells rotted, get it out of the house.
Yeah.
But the heart of the ham might still be quite fine.
Yeah. It's always been refrigerated and the vacuum still looks like it's intact. So
you try it. Yeah.
I'm going to try it then.
Trust your nose. And trust your common sense.
Oh, I appreciate it. Yeah. Thank you so much. And my son and I just love your show.
Thank you.
You are so entertaining. It always makes me so hungry.
Thanks, Donna.
Thank you. I'm from Pittsburgh, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Town I want to explore.
Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
By the way, this business about cured meats and how long they keep, if they've been cured in the old way, in the sense of not pumped with liquid the way a lot of modern hams are, but just, salted and seasoned with perhaps spices and left to hang to dry. And if they still have air circulating around them and you keep them kind of cool, they keep 4 years. The only thing is they get very strong tasting. Aficionados often love that flavor. They really adore it. They'll trim away the fat that really kind of smells rancid, and they'll get to the meat. They'll trim away any meat they don't think is really super, and they'll get to the heart of it, and they think it's just swell. But the thing is, you got to trust your nose. It's common sense. Reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see who is up next. We have Erin on the line. Erin, what's up?
Hi, Lynn. I'm wondering what to do or what you recommend doing with kohlrabi.
Oh, you mean the knobby thing that has stems coming out of it? It's pale green, right?
Knobby and ugly, yes.
Yeah. Oh, I don't think it's ugly. it's like that child that you have that has an interesting face as opposed to a breathtakingly gorgeous one. Well, the best thing you can do with kohlrabi, I think, is eat it raw. It's sweet. It's really, it's crunchy. I dice it and I put it into green salads. Okay. I toss it with lemon juice and dark mustard and a little mayonnaise and chopped onion, and I make like a salad out of it. And I do it in sticks. And the other thing that's really neat to do with it is slice it into thin rounds. Use it as a dip scoop. For anything that you're dipping, from salsa to anything creamy. And the other thing I do is I put fresh cheese on it. And it's really tasty. Put something like a boursin, something that has garlic in it and herbs.
Fresh cheese on raw kohlrabi?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, use it like a cracker.
Okay, but have you cooked it?
I have cooked it. I have to tell you, quite frankly, I don't think it's half as good cooked as it is raw.
Can I tell you something I tried?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Boiled it.
Yeah.
Until tender, sauteed it in butter and then cracked pepper, and then added red pepper flakes and fresh basil.
Oh, that sounds good.
And I was really surprised, but I just wondered if you had any ideas for cooking it.
Well, we've cooked it. I've done it where I've sliced it thin and I've sauteed it in olive oil, and then I've thrown in the garlic and that kind of thing. And since I always get it at the farmer's market, I'm always doing it in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't resist, sweet peppers go in there and that kind of thing. And yours sounds great. Of course, I think if you cook anything and saute it in butter and then add those ingredients.
Well, I got that from you, of course.
I'm very flattered.
Good. Thank you.
Never doubt. Saute it in butter. It's got to taste good.
Sounds good.
Enjoy the kohlrabi.
Thank you. Bye.
Goodbye. Kohlrabi is one of those orphan vegetables. Nobody pays any attention to it. At this time of year, at least in our markets, it's really cheap. And it's tasty. And it's the kind of thing, if you don't tell kids what it is, it's crunchy and they like to nibble on it. Just don't tell them it's kohlrabi. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. So until next week, let me leave you with this thought. Eat well, stay fit, die anyway. Anything you heard here today can be tracked down on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting, take a look at the Splendid Table store. All the proceeds go to support the show. And there's something new up on that website as well. Our new web program called Tuesday Night Kitchen. It's a whole different show, and it's only on the web. So have a listen. Our show is produced by Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.